This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is currently the 7th of July, 2010, and tonight I am joined on the line once again by Charlie Veach of the Love Police at cveach.org. Charlie, great to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining me again.
No, thanks, James. It's good to be back on the show, especially with a Canadian. And I know we spoke just before I went out to Toronto, and it was my first time ever in Canada, so it seems quite fitting that... You know, my first YouTube appearance back is with a Canadian, so let's do this.
Well, I'm honored to have you on again, and as I'm sure most of my listeners and viewers are aware by now, that you had a very interesting experience in Toronto for the G20, so I don't know really where to start with all of this, but why don't you start and pick it up wherever you want and just tell people a little bit about your experience.
Yeah, well, I'll start at the ending, with the ending ended with me on the 1st of July, 2 days after my scheduled departure date. My girlfriend managed to book me a last-minute Air India flight leaving Toronto Airport. So there I found myself walking around the duty-free area of Toronto International, Pearson Airport, looking out for police, looking out for security, trying to hide, trying to cover my face, not listening to music in case someone crept up on me, because I was so scared that the Toronto Police Department would handcuff me and drag me away just as I was about to board this last flight. It's a really strange feeling being in a Western, industrialized, civilized country and feeling like the Gestapo are out to get you, and that's precisely how I felt. My trip began 3 days before the G20 was due to begin. I arrived in Toronto on the 23rd at 3 p.m., and then at 3 p.m. on the 24th, I was in handcuffs for 5 hours and then in the Torontonomo Bay, the big detention center at the film studios, in a big metal cage for 21 hours. So my experience of the New World Order paramilitary black-booted stormtroopers was very direct, very intimate, very personal. And if I ever did think that around the world, in other industrialized Commonwealth countries, the police were huggable and approachable and friendly and actually human beings, I was proven, sadly, very wrong. So out of my 7 days in Canada, I spent 48 hours in incarceration, most of them with my hands handcuffed, and being paraded before a judge, having lawyers come to see me, sharing a cell with wife beaters and crack addicts and people who've assaulted other people, people pouring with blood. I picked up a nasty cold. And who knows what else I picked up in jail. Luckily, I wasn't raped, only psychologically by the system. So luckily, James, it hasn't clouded my impression of Canada or Canadians. I know the issues you guys have with the kind of stormtrooper police acting like the biggest gang in town, which is what they are. They're a corporate revenue collection mafia, is a problem we have with any country which is part of the G20 industrialized, so supposed civilized countries. So now I find myself in London, faced with two court appearances in Toronto on the 15th of July, which is in 8 days, and on the 23rd of August. So what a wonderful way to start the summer months.
Yes, wonderful indeed. And the original arrest, obviously, because of the heinous and egregious sin of not presenting your papers when demanded, even though, as it turns out, you weren't actually required by law to present your papers, despite the lies of the Toronto police chief and all of that rigmarole, which I'm sure people have been looking into, but if not, they can definitely check some of that out in my Sunday update and Dan Dix at pressfortruth.ca and all sorts of things. So, absolutely. Well, let's... I don't want to just dwell on the incarceration, although that obviously is a huge part of what happened, but talk a little bit about your experience there and meeting Dan Dix and some of the things that you were involved in that wasn't so horribly depressing.
Yeah, it's quite funny. Dan Dix lives right by the CN Tower in central Toronto. He lives literally a stone's throw away from the G20 security fence. We found it both very interesting that you can see on the video, we're trying to reason with the sergeant who had one of those, you know, kind of US Marine crew cuts and the big thug face and big steroid muscles and the big mustache, which I have to say, the police in Toronto seem to love sporting the mustache. Something about that Stalin Hitler look, which, you know, fascist men find so irresistible. So, yeah, hooked up with Dan Dix. I'd seen a lot of his work from Press for Truth online. He did some good work covering the kind of terror drills they were doing in Toronto before the G20. So he seemed like the natural person to hook up with. And luckily, it was fantastic. And it's just crazy that 2 hours after starting filming together, I get myself arrested by the, you know, by the Gestapo tactics. And very funnily enough, the police chief, the Toronto mayor, have all come out and admitted that the law under which I was arrested never was put into place. Excuse me. So I might even have the potential of suing the Toronto state for illegal incarceration and psychological trauma if I wish to be so, creative with what I want to do. But no, Dan and I and his crew, we managed to cover the whole G20 riots and the riots and inverted commas. We all know Black Bloc are not who they say they are. There's enough documented photo evidence of, you know, they use the same boots, the same wooden truncheons as the police. And I saw with my own eyes, I couldn't get close enough to film it, but I saw with my own eyes the police retreat from a police car which had its window open, nice for the Black Bloc to set fire to. And I'm actually on a... I've just seen an article online just now from the Montreal Gazette, which shows that 80% of Ontario residents, of the ones they polled, believe the police did a good job. And I don't know where they found these 80% of people, but they can't be people who were witnessing the same event that I was, because what I saw was... Toronto turned into a dystopian vision of the future, somewhere between The Matrix, Blade Runner, and Mad Max. It was insane to see that many police, who outnumbered the protesters 2-1. There was 19,000 riot cops to 10,000 protesters. I believe the mainstream media hype kept thousands of people away from Toronto because of fear. And the one thing, as we all know, that sells more than sex is fear. And they were all terrified to be there. And I'm not surprised, because I'm quite loud when I go out on the megaphone. And I had a kind of police camera team. All they were missing was a boom mic and maybe a sound engineer to follow me around. They had these $10,000 professional HD studio quality cameras that these riot police were carrying around, filming me and filming other people. And I was joking around with them, saying, look, I hope you put it on your police YouTube or your Facebook and, you know, tag me so I can see it. And they weren't so funny. But the good news behind all this, whilst we were making fun of the whole situation, a few of the police behind their plastic visor helmets did burst into laughter, did start smiling and smirking. So they're not all robot drone slaves. I think there are some human beings. But still, why are they taking part in something? If I was a Toronto police officer after seeing Toronto, what happened to it, I'd have thrown my badge and my gun down on my sheriff's desk and said, look, to hell with this job. I'm sorry, this is not what I signed up for. And you can stick the pension where the sun don't shine, because I didn't become a public servant to serve and protect in order to beat down teenage boys and girls with truncheons and fire tear gas into elderly ladies' faces. So it's... This is just consciousness stream coming out now.
That's right, but as you mentioned in our conversation before you left, these cops are fed this steady diet of clips of violent protesters attacking cops and being trained that we're the enemy, so they get put into that position and then they start enacting that, and the Black Bloc protesters come along and do their job, and then everything breaks out. And so we see how these things escalate, and I guess the question is, how could this have turned out differently? Is there any way that this could have turned out in any other way?
Yes. What the police really should have done is allowed the protesters to move around freely throughout the city. And what they should have done, because they had the resources, they had helicopters and tanks. By tanks, I mean they had these kind of... I don't know how to describe them, somewhere between an assault vehicle and a truck, these big armored truck things, and 19,000 riot cops. They could have allowed the kind of peaceful protesters to walk anywhere in the city and instantly arrested these so-called Black Bloc anarchists. But what I could see, James, what was very apparent to Dan Dix and myself, was that it seemed to be they were using the Toronto G20 protests as a a militarized police training drill to deal with an urban fallout situation after maybe a second economic collapse, or after a false flag release to flu, in which, where civil society breaks down. So it did very much seem that we were part of some sort of military army training taking place in a central city, because Dan Dix and I were actually part of that. It was actually at Queen and Spadina, where they did the kind of blocking off of the protesters. It was like, you know, men, women, children, dogs, parrots, anyone they could corral into this small street. We were part of that protest, and luckily we had to break off from that to appear on the Alex Jones show. And then those 400 people got circled by the police, and they were doing this weird tactic, which I'm sure you've seen the videos, where they had the riot cops all lined up, and then they would open up for a second, two or three other officers would run in and grab a girl around the neck and tear her away from her boyfriend as she's screaming and crying, and they'd carry on doing that. So it was almost like from Alice in Wonderland, the kind of card soldiers is suddenly snapping sideways. A few thugs would run in and grab people, and the fact that I was kept in a massive black warehouse with industrialized strip lighting and in cages, and all I could see was endless rows of cages as far as the eye could almost see in this big American football stadium-sized warehouse. It was a protester processing center, the PPC, and the very fact that they have a center exclusively to deal with protesters is a scary, scary watershed that we've passed now.
It sure is. And you're right. I mean, there's no doubt this is just the latest test of the latest upgrade of the urban warfare fallout scenario planning that they're doing. And it's just a laboratory for this type of thing. And we saw the horrific results of that, not only the warehouse processing, but also the cops ripping the legs off of prosthetic legs off of amputees, women saying that they were strip searched by male officers and violated, and just horrific story after horrific story. And I recently saw a video of a police officer when confronted by people saying that they didn't have to let him search their bag because this was Canada and there's the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. He said, "This isn't Canada, this is the G20," which was a horrific, horrific thing to hear from someone in a uniform like that. Just almost incomprehensible. And I, just to play devil's advocate, and I'm not obviously disparaging your work or anything you're doing, but the question is, to what extent do we feed into the system by engaging it in this type of thing?
That's a very good question. And you actually touched upon this in one of your earlier podcasts about a year and a half ago, when you said that perhaps shows like the Alex Jones or even the Corbett Reports or maybe the Love Police, we are an inoculation where we're almost like the pressure release valve, which maybe people kind of gather around on the internet and say, "Oh, well, Alex Jones, James Corbett, they're doing all the information, we can just settle back." So, I'm very kind of, I resonate strongly with the idea of total resistance, and I need to face a very difficult choice in the near future, because if I were to send a lawyer or turn up to the Toronto courts at the appointed dates, it would be, in a way, consenting to their invitation to be tried by a system which I believe has been fully compromised by the dark forces, you know, of the, we shall call them the Illuminati or the corporate scumbags which run this world. So I worry. I was once called a court jester, sucking the New World Order's cock, which was interesting. And some other people say it's a distraction to have, you know, people running around protesting when there's other real issues at stake. So it's a very, very good and pertinent question, James, that you ask, is how much are we playing into their system? Between doing what I do and, you know, moving to the highlands in Colombia to train with the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, the FARC, this is all I can think of right now. But if, let's say, hypothetically, I do not recognize the authority of the Canadian courts over me, and there is an attempt to extradite me because Canada and Britain are, you know, close partners in the Commonwealth, I would have to make a decision to disappear and go underground and live my life as a fugitive. Hopefully, it will not come to that, because I believe this is just a show trial and insanity. But, let me ask the question back at you, James. How much are we playing into the parts of this disgusting system which brutalizes hundreds of millions of innocent people?
Well, I ask you the question because it's a question I think about all the time, and I think about increasingly, and I don't know how to answer it. I don't know if we are playing into the system, but again, I don't know what else to be doing. I don't think I'm going to be running away to Colombia to join the FARC, so I don't know what the alternatives are, really, but I just know that things seem to keep getting darker and darker, and there has to be a way to as you say, as your whole point is, to lower the fear and to raise love, but it seems like it's a very uphill battle.
Yeah, it is an uphill battle, and a lot of people tell me that things need to get worse before they get better, and people said that my getting arrested twice in such ridiculous circumstances did help expose the illusion of police there to serve and protect. But I think maybe it does need to get a bit worse before it gets better, because for the average man and woman on the street working in an office, earning a bit of money for their pension, making their car payments, paying their mortgage, they don't want to admit there is a problem until the problem comes to them. So until their son is beaten and detained by thugs, or until their sister has her private parts fingered by, court staff at some detention center on the outskirts of Toronto, then they won't want to know about it. So it sounds really horrible to say this, but we just need to have the power structure in place keep exposing itself and make mistakes. And it does need to carry on making mistakes. And I think it was from the film Gandhi who said, through their... through their brutality upon us, we will show them our humanity. So I'm not a total devotee of what Gandhi advocated. I believe the political situation in India was turning anyway before Gandhi came on the scene. But I don't know if I'm strong enough or man enough to take all these blows and not react like a human being, because there is something romantic about the Colombian Revolution, or the struggles of the Irish Republican Army against the British during the Troubles in Ireland. I am very ambivalent towards violent uprisings, because sometimes I can see that in order to remain human, you have to take sides. And there's a very interesting essay, I can't remember who wrote it, maybe even a Canadian, called Pacifism as Pathology, which I recommend all the listeners and viewers to look up online, Pacifism as Pathology. And it talks about how the Black Panthers or some other groups in America were basically neutered by the kind of libertarian, liberal advocates of total, passive, and peaceful resistance, when in fact some of these groups were starting to do some good work. So I hope we never have to come down to that, but... if I'm faced with a choice between allowing thugs into my house to, to put my family into a camp, or fighting back, I think the choice would be very easy to make when the time comes. But like you, James, I wrestle with the question every day.
Yeah, well, these are fundamental questions, and they're not easy to answer. But just personally, I'm not on the side of violence. I don't think we're going to win through violence. I really don't think so. And I don't know. I don't know if I'm right, but I just cannot advocate violence as a way of bringing peace. I just fundamentally don't think that that's right. And I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, we're all just looking for these answers. But I guess so. The question is: assuming that this ridiculous show trial coming up in Ottawa or in Toronto does not, ruin you forever. I mean, how will this affect your work? How has this changed you, or how have these experiences affected your outlook?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's put the worry in me that whenever I travel far away from home, I can get kidnapped, and I have been kidnapped twice and held, on these trumped up charges. I'm obviously hoping for either a dropping of the charges or a complete not guilty verdict for both of them. But it won't really affect the work I do. It'll carry on. But I guess I just need to be a bit smarter about it. But it's terrible, James, the idea to think that I might have to self-censor and worry about what I say in case of kidnapping by thugs. It would be a victory to the dark forces if I were to compromise my message or what I do because of fear But I have to admit, I am scared. I am scared. I've lost sleep over it. It was very traumatic. It was the worst experience of my life. And you see how they, if they make you a bit scared, they own you a little bit. And it's a very, very invasive and horrible feeling to be suffering. But going forward, I think I want to maybe... I've always been against organizations or pyramid structures, but I need to maybe develop a community around me, or not around me, but a community of like-minded people to look out for each other, maybe a few hundred or a thousand or so people who will almost in a way be a gang, but a gang for good, to look out for each other, because as individuals we can't achieve anything hardly, and it's just nice to know we have family and friends. And a community, I think, is necessary.
I agree wholeheartedly. We don't need hierarchical pyramidal structures, but we definitely need groups of like-minded individuals to come together at times of need and watch out for each other, for sure.
Yeah. What's the situation like in Japan with the New World Order and the police state, James?
That's a good question. The police, I would say, are not a presence here in a day-to-day, everyday sort of setting. There was a G8 conference here recently, last year, I believe, and there was a lot of security around that, but there wasn't a lot of protest. I mean, Japan is not known for its violent street protests and things, at least not in the recent years. So you wouldn't notice the police on a day-to-day basis here, but they do have powers to do things like foreigners who are in Japan have to carry around a foreign identification card, and they have to present it to police upon request. There's no arguing about it, and if you don't have it, they can send you to jail for it. So, I mean, there are some pretty repressive things going on, but the police state as a presence that you would notice on the street is just not really something here. In fact, crime is not usually so in your face here. It's not as pressing as it is in a lot of Western countries.
No. It's funny, when I landed back in Britain, and my girlfriend picked me up from Heathrow Airport in London, and it's funny because I've done maybe about 100 videos on YouTube, and most of them include some form of hugging or cuddling the police, and there's smiles, and there's that human connection. And after leaving Canada and coming back to Britain, I'd almost look fondly with a slight tear in my eye when the police van went past with the sirens blazing. Because I can't stress enough psychologically how much it is a matter of respect for the public that the police are not armed with pistols. And the fact that they're public servants and that they don't carry weapons of death makes, I think, the British public behave maybe more in a more civilized manner, and they have a lot more respect for the police. So I never thought I'd hear myself say this, but after my time in North America, and again, I want to stress it's not a Canada issue, it's a New World Order G20 issue, but after my time in Canada dealing with the Toronto thugs, and maybe Torontonians are much more like America because of the proximity to the border, I don't know. But I never thought I'd say that the British police, I, in a way, missed them. And I missed their reasoned and level approach when dealing with people on the street. It's a much more, perhaps, a psychological police state in Britain, whereas in North America, it's a much more cowboy, physical police state presence. And I can't stress enough how British police, when dealing with an issue of free speech or public performance, they will really scratch their heads and think of ways to not have to arrest you because they don't want to do it. And I could be outside Downing Street, the British equivalent of the White House, with a megaphone, with police sergeants and officers all looking at me, all shouting at me, and they will really kind of bend over backwards to not have to deal with you and not have to do the paperwork. But I can, as I saw with my own experience in Toronto, 1 hour of megaphoning led to questioning as to my papers and then an arrest. So what I'm trying to say in a long-winded way is hooray for the British police. Please don't all fall victims to this international brainwashing which your bosses are trying to put under. And one more thing, if I can say one good thing for the British police, which I just want to say as well, they're not paying me to say this, I've got no affiliation with the police. The police chiefs in Britain rejected the Home Office's desire to arm every single police officer with tasers, you know, the electronic torture weapons. Why did the police chiefs reject this extra weaponry, and why was the British Home Office, the Home Secretary, wanting them to have these electronic torture weapons? So, hooray for the British police, and thank God they voted against arming all their officers with stun guns.
Absolutely. Well, I must admit, after having seen the horrors of the G20, I'm looking forward to seeing more lighthearted interactions with British police and hugging and smiling and laughing and joking rather than armed, well, everyone knows, yes, armed police state officers. All right. Well, absolutely. Well, so, well, Charlie, I guess just wrapping things up, is there anything you want to say to the audience out there, or anything you want people to get behind, or that anything they can do to support you at this time?
No, I just want to say thank you for all the incredible messages of support I've had, and all the physical support on the ground by the people who came to pick me up outside the Toronto courthouse. I just want people to never lose the faith, never lose the hope that human beings are something worth standing up for, and that it's only through standing up for each other that we can actually discover the divinity of what it means to be a human being. Happiness will only come in helping others, and perhaps, I just want to end with this, that it's the people who hurt the most that hurt other people the most. And imagine how brutalized the North American police feel having to wear those uniforms and drive around in their cars with shotguns and big guns and be part of a fascist culture which makes them take steroids and testosterone supplements and shave their heads like Marines. It must be very, very difficult for their souls as human beings to have to deal with that. So I think we just need a message of forgiveness, but also of reminding each other that our lives have value as human beings, and that there is a breaking point where we will, you know, start to stand up for each other and much more organized and aggressive ways. But hopefully it'll never come to that, and I don't want it to ever come to that, but I am a human being, and there are things which I would happily die for, one of them obviously being my friends and family and my girlfriend. So it's just, well, what I'm trying to say is, let's not let history repeat itself, and just let's all stick together.
And watch what you're saying about shaved heads. I'll have you know it's a noble haircut. All right, Charlie Veach, cveach.org. We're behind you. We support you, and looking forward to more of your incredible work in the future. Thank you again for coming on today.
Thanks, James, for having me on. I'll speak to you soon.